the amount of boxes that you can tick by going down that passive house pathway, it's like, it's not two birds, one stone, it's about 10. When you look at it like that, the value for money on achieving it is insane, because you're talking about, you know, future-proofing yourself against all the stuff that's coming, let alone better experience for the tenant, let alone lower power bills, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Welcome to the Passive House Podcast, brought to you by Passive House Accelerator, a catalyst for zero carbon building. For news, inspiration, and connections from all flavors of Passive House, check out passivehouseaccelerator.com. Sign up to receive regular updates about events, get your questions answered, and contribute to the community dialogue. There's loads of free information for experienced professionals and people just starting out on their Passive House journey. We hope to see you at one of our weekly Passive House Accelerator live webinars. In the meantime, here's this week's Passive House podcast. Hello and welcome back to the Passive House podcast. I'm Matthew Cutler-Walsh, coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland in New Zealand.
And I'm Zach Semke, coming to you from Seattle, Washington on the Salish Sea.
It's been a while, Zach. Well, it's been a while since we've done a regular episode, just the two of us.
I know, it has been. And I missed a couple of the most recent episodes because we were so head down getting ready for RB24, Reimagine Buildings 24, which is a wrap.
It is has been a wrap. I guess by the time this comes out, it'll be
for a couple
over a week.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing. I missed the first hour, unfortunately, because it was relatively early in the morning for me, my time. But I ended up staying quite a lot longer than I expected for the 24 hours. I think you were among a few people that stayed for the whole 24.
Not quite. I almost made it, but
you're not 20 anymore.
The definition of being there was being within 6 feet of your computer while it's running, then yes. But there was a moment that I got 90 minutes of sleep, I think, at about 3 o'clock my time.
Yeah.
Kim and I were taking turns a little bit to get refreshed. I actually had to talk at the very end of the conference. So I was like, all right, if I'm going to be even halfway coherent, I do actually need to sleep
a little bit. I did catch the last – I woke up and because I wanted to hear the wrap up at the end, and I have to say you were sounding remarkably fresh, and I don't know how much of that was just the buzz, but also I remember that last hour was incredibly inspiring. The presentation
is good.
Is that folks. Particular hour?
Yeah.
I feel like even Michael was a bit speechless.
Yeah, I mean that last hour was. I mean, we had Shefali Songvi from Datner Architects, Jacob Deva Rakusen from New Frameworks, New Energy Frameworks, and we also had Lori Ferris from the Climate Heritage Network and Architecture 2030. And she pre-recorded her talk. She was at that moment actually in Paris at this big global climate forum on buildings that was going on. It was amazing. It was, you know, really, really great people, super insightful. And also, you know, like we've got major challenges, but we also have lots of opportunities to make a big difference.
Yeah, we do. So I know that people that were in attendance would have received an email pretty soon afterwards letting them know that some of the content is available. There's also the magazine that Mary and the team published just prior to Reimagine. Where else can people find out stuff if they missed the event or missed particular sections of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the magazine is a Reimagine Buildings issue of the magazine. Jay Fox and Mary James did an amazing job on it, so that you can go to the Passive House Accelerator website and download that for free. And it features a lot of the same players who presented. And then we will have a special section on the website that is for people who've registered for the conference, and we'll probably provide a way for people to access that for some nominal fee. There will also be drawing on these amazing leaders for the podcast and for future programming. So it's going to, I think the whole effort will infuse what we're doing at the Accelerator for, you know, months for sure.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And if you missed it, don't miss the next one.
Well, I guess everyone's asking, you know, what's happening next year?
Yeah. Well, we're going to do, it'll be different. But we're definitely, we feel a lot of momentum after the event. So we've got plans for some smaller, some smaller stuff. And then a full day event. It may not be 24 hours this next time. We'll see.
Yeah. At the risk of pulling back the curtain too much, I know that there was discussion, a bit of a debrief, and there was a – I hadn't realized that there was so much skepticism about running a virtual event of that nature, but it seems that a lot of those people changed their mind after attending.
Yeah, I think the platform was really effective. Mm. And it's a – I mean, for people who were there, they would have seen sort of a whole different kind of production value. It was not the same as being on a Zoom call. I mean, it's obviously it's an online experience, so there are some similarities, but it was not the same. It was very kind of tightly choreographed briefer, like presentations went from 7 to 18 minutes long. And they were just like, it was rapid fire. And then some really different ways to connect with people via networking as well.
I think the networking and the chats, like some of the sessions that I were at, it was, if that had been a real conference, it would have been pretty loud in the audience because everyone was just chatting to each other.
Yeah, that's right.
In a good way. You know, there was a lot of engagement, which I know happens during lives, Passive House lives, and which is a big part of it. It's not just a one-to-many sit and listen, but there's a lot of interaction that's going on and people sharing ideas. So it's very, very cool. Awesome. Hey, well done once again to you, Michael. Certainly Kim and Cara behind the scenes during the event. I know she almost did the whole 24 hours.
I think she was really close. Kim kind of had to force her to take a break.
So very, very impressive. But we do have some other news, some other and in fact, an interview to bring you this week. But before we do that, we've got a few people to thank.
Yes, absolutely. So a big thank you to our sponsors who make the podcast possible. So a big thank you to our stakeholder partner, NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. Thank you also to our founding sponsors, 475 High Performance Building Supply, Glavel, Ingui Architecture, Minotaur, Partel, Rockwell North America, Stocorp, and Zola Windows. Thanks as well to our champion sponsors, Buizo, Gradient, Icon Windows and Doors, Intelligent Membranes, PH Air Seal, Prosico, and Source 2050.
Awesome. All right. Well, it was almost a year ago that I head off to Sydney for the Passive House Australia Thrive Conference, and Zach, you beamed in with your presentation, which was very popular.
The Solar Punk. Yes, that was fun.
And it was a great event. I think it was the first time that the Passive House Conference in Australia was solely Australian focused, so sort of split off between in the past we had done South Pacific ones when New Zealand and Australia were quite small organisations, but sort of the coming of age of both organisations now, sort of big enough and industries have matured enough to and there's so much great content, which I think this interview shows. And aside from, of course, your hit presentation, Zach, the other very popular presentation of the day was Ben Sinclair, who is in Queensland in relatively warm sort of tropical part of Australia up the east coast. And I always love hearing from builders or people, you know, developers who haven't necessarily come from an architecture background, that they're not like, they don't start off as full passive house evangelists, but through a series of events which Ben talks about in this conversation, sort of comes to recognize some of the benefits and then becomes a very keen advocate, but with a commercial bent to it, which I think is really useful for the rest of us, because he's doing this as a business. And it is one of the first passive house commercial buildings in Australia. It's more than that. It's one of the very first to be passive house Green Star, which is Australian flavour of LEED, and also a WELL building. It achieved the WELL building standard. So a pretty amazing achievement. And as Ben explains, that was a bit of a gamble for him and his family business, which is developing commercial property, because they didn't really know if it was going to attract any additional value for doing all that. So he goes on to talk about that. Just a quick mention, Ben, he talks about something called Neighbours, which is a very popular TV program in Australia that's been running for many, many years. But it's also a national Australia built environment rating system. So that's what NABERS stands for. It's pretty well known in Australia because it's required for a lot of buildings. And the cool thing about NABERS is that it's an operational standard. So you have to have 12 months worth of energy use data and also indoor environment data in order to be able to get a NABERS rating, because it's not just how little energy you can use over a year, but you have to show how well you've maintained the internal temperature and a few other parameters. So NABERS is that scheme. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. You can have a look at it. It also covers off water, waste, and indoor environment quality. So that's what Ben is talking to about. That's what he's referring to when he talks about NABERS. All right. Well, let's get into it. This is my chat with Ben Sinclair of Corner Block. So, Ben Sinclair, thanks for joining us on the Passive House podcast.
No, great. It's been trying to catch on for a while, but we've made it happen.
Almost. Well, coming up to, what was it, March last year was Thrive?
Yes. Yeah. Correct. March.
Which has flown by, but you were definitely one of the highlight presentations, certainly for me, and I think a lot of people there, I remember commenting afterwards, I really enjoyed your presentation because it was quite different. Because I think your background's a bit different from some of the typical audience there, but also a really great project which we'll get into. But let's start off with your background, because you're not an architect or a builder, are you?
No, relatively untraditional in that sense, in terms of my background and history and experiences and how I've learnt what I've learnt and my motivations. But certainly, being none of those pigeonholes, and I don't say that in a negative way, but allows me to then actually cross multiple different areas and, you know, really be involved on the design side, the specification, the project management, the building ownership, the construction, and then, you know, now the tenant experience of that one space. So, yeah, being able to cross it all facets, I think it's got, yeah, certainly got some advantages, lots of work and sleepless nights.
Yeah.
And taking responsibility for lots of the building aspects that would normally be other people's, you know, end responsibilities. But, I think it helps to get to that final optimized solution.
What would you say is your skill set? What's your experience work-wise been prior to the Corner Block project?
Yeah, well, look, my family business is involved in self-storage and shipping containers. My partner's had various retail businesses. So it's really very, very varied. But I think that the common denominator out of all this is, you know, just that if I see a problem or a pain point, and I maybe that's, you know, it's hard to pinpoint my exact skill set because I don't have a qualification and such, but I think it's really about being able to observe and then identify pain points within whatever topic or industry that I'm looking at that time. So those varied experiences, and, you know, I spent a fair bit of time in China with family business, so a bit of international travel and looking at, you know, issues facing other people in that sort of area. And ironically, starting off in that shipping container world, they're just mini buildings, effectively. Yeah. So that, you know, I guess my interest in architecture and design and construction and structural integrity and manufacturing technique and products, you know, all sort of stem from that in a weird little concise steel box. But yeah, coming out of that and being able to see the pain points, I think that's really my skill set now. And then maintaining a vision to solve said pain points and being relatively stubborn about it in terms of not compromising, which is a double-edged sword, but to, you know, really getting to that ultimate end goal. You know, it's paid off, and, you know, you've got to have a labor of love project, I think, to really kind of bed that sort of stuff down to start off with.
Mm. So what would you say is the pain point that you observed when you saw this corner block of land?
Well, the pain point that I was actually watching was directly across the road, and they were building industrial buildings. So a developer had come in, built tilt panel industrial sheds, and then every person that purchased them then was fitting out office space inside these industrial sheds and then lifting hundreds of kilowatts of air conditioning onto the roof of these industrial sheds, and even silly things down to having to add structural support to the roof because the size of the air conditioning is so big. And it just, you know, it just seemed like you were shoehorning something into a building that wasn't, that shouldn't be there.
Right.
So then, yeah, so looking at other people's pain points and watching what they were doing. So once the Corner Block project came up, you know, the opportunity arose for me to be involved. And it's like, well, instead of pushing, it's not a pain point for the developer because what do they care what you use it for, but it's a pain point for the tenant or, you know, the next person that inherits all those pain points. So it's not necessarily about those initial ones, but it's about, you know, inheritance of pain points. And so it's really about, okay, well, let's stop that from happening. And let's think about what people are actually using the space for, or yes, there's a council zoning for it to be industrial land, but then people end up using it as office space, so let's build it as that.
Were developers building a very simple concrete tilt slab, empty shell, because that's the cheapest and easiest thing for them to do? Or were they generally thinking, oh, somebody will use this as a small workshop or a factory or storage space?
They were doing it because return on investment
right.
was super high, and it was certainly during, you know, well, it's only accelerated since COVID, but owner-occupier sales, so typical tilt panel developments on the Gold Coast, owner-occupiers are paying above the odds, you know, in terms of dollars per square metre. So why build anything different than what people are already buying? You know, quick and easy to make, super fast return on investment,
right.
limited risk in terms of, you know, all those sort of things. So
super easy, I think cheap to build.
Yeah. And
someone's going to rent it.
I mean, and also that, you know, in Australia, consumers are relatively lazy. So the people out there aren't asking for something better. They're not right. saying, no, I'm not going to buy your tilt panel factory because it's not fitted out for office space. They buy it and then expect that they're going to do the fit out themselves. So, a few different angles.
And
on
just,
that.
Just for context, what is now the demand and the relative demand for commercial office space as opposed to pure industrial space?
In our specific area, it's still probably high, and there's, you know, a few geographical specific things going on where we are. But I think generally, you know, people are heading back to the office, right? Like, there's this whole sort of talk around
yep.
no longer working from home and stuff. So I think office space is still, I think it's going to have a fair bit of demand attached onto it. I just think that high quality office space will be the highest demanded one. As we move into a carbon neutral future, which, you know, wasn't really talked about. No one had any idea when we started Corner Block Project. But certainly now, you know, NABERS ratings and energy efficiency and carbon emissions and carbon emission factors and all this sort of stuff is, you know, the first sort of topic of conversation,
yeah.
especially with larger office space areas.
Yeah, yeah, you're definitely ahead of the curve there. Speaking of your geographic area, you're in the Gold Coast. Mm-hmm. As we're recording this early on in February 2024, we were just talking, you've experienced some pretty warm weather recently, but what's the, for our international listeners, what's the climate like where you are?
Yeah, well, subtropical is probably the
just, you know, subtropical.
Just subtropical. Yeah,
pretty close to tropical.
It feels, and you know, some. I think this is a really good, you know, point in terms of changing climate. And you know, if you look at, I was saying to someone the other day, if you look at 20 years of historical climate data, you can almost say it's irrelevant. You know, the last 2 or 3 years is probably the most relevant. So, you know, we were talking about the day that we had the other day, 38 degrees, 91% humidity. I had a dew point of 26 degrees. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I certainly don't remember another day like that.
Yeah. But I mean, that's tropical conditions. With the dew point that high.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. And I think that whilst, you know, the two things are happening, right? We've got one, our climate zone is pretty demanding when it comes to, you know, humidity and temperature. Certainly there's more demanding ones the further north you go. But people's thermal comfort expectations are also changing as well. So, you know, it's a bit of a perfect storm.
Well, yeah, not only that, but I mean, it's getting to a point where it's a health and safety issue as well. Like if you consider that example that you described of a tilt slab, I mean, essentially a concrete box with a metal roof with minimal insulation, I'm guessing, on an industrial building like that. It must be getting to a point where it's not safe for someone to be working probably physically in a setting in that space for 8 hours in the middle of the day.
No, definitely not. And, you know, the an example, maybe they're probably 30 kilometres north of us towards Brisbane. So, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 square metre industrial shed, similar sort of construction, tilt-up panel, minimal insulation. I was talking to someone that was in charge of workplace health and safety there, and they said in the middle of summer, so they've got a couple hundred people working in there, and they have, on average, 4 people a day faint.
Jeepers.
I mean, like, yeah, again, a couple of things, you know, increase in climate, you know, temperature and you know, more extreme days combined together with people, you know, and the irony is in those sort of workplaces, they're trying to fix safety by getting people to wear long pants and long shirts and heavy cotton shirts and all this sort of stuff, and it's just sort of compounding the problem.
Got their high vis on and their helmets and...
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, so they're trying to be safe in one direction and it's actually causing, you know, problems in another direction.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the whole, you know, while we're sort of having these sort of conversations and being able to show that really science can actually predict this, and then that allows people to actually, you know, come up with some solutions around fixing it.
Yeah. So you're a business guy, experienced in working with containers, storage, sort of that industrial sector. When did you first hear about Passive House?
Well, ironically, it was 12 months into the design phase of designing Corner Block. So
was a good time to start thinking about Passive House when you're through into the design.
Yeah, yeah, when you're halfway. Yeah. So we're 2 years in design, so we're halfway through. Yeah. And you know, it came about because of those pain points that I was talking about with the industrial buildings next door and the quantity of air conditioning that was being fitted into those spaces. And you know, it actually came about from an aesthetics point of view of the size of those units and where we were going to put them on site. And I just didn't physically have the space to put really large chiller units on site. So that's where it started from. And it was, you know, I went down a crazy rabbit hole of looking at centralized chilled water and pumping chilled water and, you know, figuring out how you'd monitor that and how you'd build tenants for that and, you know, all that sort of thing. And then looking at, you know, other more industrial systems that you probably see at, you know, airports and shopping centres.
Big units.
Yeah, huge units. And thinking, oh, well, if we centralised it, then you'd get some savings out of that. But then the real estate that even that took up and the complexity around maintaining it and all that sort of stuff. And then, yeah, it was really, you know, just endless nights on Google and, you know, the rabbit hole that you can go down that the internet can cause led me to then thinking about, okay, let's not think about how to solve the problem with a Band-Aid and with a better quality Band-Aid, but let's think about actually fixing the sore, the cyst that's the underlying problem. You know, let's do that. So, yeah, then really Passive House sort of accelerated those conversations. And quickly realised that this was the pathway. The irony was is that we were already looking at Green Star. So we'd already committed to the wall system, double glazing, the roof system, those elements of the building, which are, you know, the big ticket items really when it comes to the thermal envelope.
Yeah.
We'd already committed to ones, and once Scott, our Passive House consultant, got involved, we quickly realised that we'd actually already specified items that were going to work.
Right.
So the redesign was minimal. It really became a game of detailing what we'd already designed rather than having to rework or change anything. So there's real minimal impact to the structural elements, minimal impact to budget because we'd already committed to these things. You know, it just became a game of how were we going to install the windows to make sure they're airtight? How were we going to install the roof to make sure it's airtight? You know, that detailing side of things.
So you're already so at the point in the design, you were already committing to office space.
Correct. So we said, okay, we're not doing what everyone else is doing. We're going to build this as office space. If we're building it as office space, then that means it's going to be conditioned. If it's going to be conditioned, let's think about the building elements that we can affect. And Green Star had sort of helped us start on that pathway, and we were thinking, you know, heading down the six-star pathway. So we were already thinking about the sort of products and materials to help to help us on that pathway. It just happened that the R values and, you know, the technical values of all the materials we'd specified actually were pretty much perfect for achieving passive house.
Was Green Star is not required laws or building regulations, but is it kind of required as a standard practice now for that Class A commercial space?
Probably more so. It's certainly, even industrial space now, even they're five Green Star rated. So one of our other motivations around it was neighbours, and looking at neighbours had gone from being a requirement for 2,000 square metre spaces down to 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as we don't have a single tenancy that is 1,000 square metres, I was like, well, if it's gone from 2,000 to 1,000, it will go to 500 in the near future.
Right.
And then looking at other people's pain points and looking at the cost and time that it was taking to, and still taking, to retrofit existing buildings to gain high star ratings with neighbours. For some buildings, it will be cost prohibitive and it'll be cheaper to knock it down and build again.
Yeah, wow.
So it's like, okay, well, let's just get our, let's get our binoculars and look a little bit into the future. If it goes to 500 square metres, then we're going to have to start displaying this as we're renting out our spaces.
Yeah.
So let's make sure that we can comply with that as well and not have zero neighbours rating when we could have six on there. So.
And I'm guessing, are you unique in being a developer and then retaining the building as an owner? Because that's a big driving force of that future-proofing, whereas it'd be easier if you're a developer just to build to whatever's required today and sell at the best return, and then it becomes somebody else's problem.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, I think that's – you've articulated the systematic problem that probably exists within most commercial real estate within Australia. There is no motivation. Why would they even put solar panels on the roof? There's zero – and even as a landlord, the tenant pays the power bill, right? So
yeah.
Builder pushes problem onto landlord pushes problem onto tenant.
Yeah.
And, so at the end of the day, it's that end user that ends up paying the price for it. And whether that's an uncomfortable building, whether that's an expensive building to run, whether that's an unhealthy building, or all of them, generally speaking, they probably end up being all of that to a degree, just gets pushed onto the it's not even to the tenant, it's the employees of the tenant that are sitting there actually using the space.
Yeah, that's right.
So, so you're right in that a unique position to be able to say, okay, we're going to build this. We're not, our view is to retain the asset forever. Let's build it with that mindset. So let's not have tenant problems, and so let's not push problems onto them. Let's fix their problems before they even are problems. Let's just out design it. And my father always says, when you lease a property, you got to sell it 12 times a year. Tenant pays monthly rent, right? So make them happy, make them feel good about paying rent every single month. You're not just selling it once when you sign them up, but they've got to pay rent all the time. So know, it's about selling that space 12 times a year, not just that once off.
It might be a bit early to say, but do you feel like this is a good business model?
I don't think that the Australian consumer is at the point of realizing the value of it yet. Certainly getting there, and you know, I think it's the wave is building, probably still a little bit early. But having said that, you know, COVID's shown how quickly things can change around in this sort of space. And that it's not something you can just turn on and off overnight. So if you're not in the space, it will take a couple of years of experience and knowledge building so that when it is important, and whether that's through legislation or through consumers and, you know, tenants voting with their wallets, you could be left flat-footed, you know, if you're not onto it sooner rather than later. So, I people are still out there buying tilt panel factories and fitting office space into it. So, you know, I think that we've moved past the step of early adopters, and I think that, you know, we're at the top end of mainstream, but it's just a slow-moving beast. So, look, I think that it's a good business model if you're planning on keeping the building. It's not a good business model if you're planning on selling it, unless you're selling it to someone that understands what you're talking about, and there's just not a lot of those people around. But certainly if you're retaining asset, and it's not, you know, I don't want this to sound like, oh, you know, the argument around passive house, oh, it costs more and then you're going to gain that money back over time and all that sort of stuff. That's, you know, it's an argument which I don't like to have, because I'm like, well, through good design, there's no reason why it should cost any extra.
Right.
But it's actually more about the maintenance and the ongoing longevity of that building, and, like I said, complying with neighbours' ratings will become 500 square metres. And next thing you know, all office spaces will have to have this rating, and you could end up with an asset that's worth nothing because of the cost, or apart from the land value minus demolition cost of your building, because it might actually be cost prohibitive to upgrade your building to the point where you can actually comply with the rules and regulations.
I think that's a really good point about you can see where those are going if you just look. I just don't know how many people are looking at that. They're just looking at, okay, what do I have to comply with today? That doesn't require you. If your plan is to sell the building, it doesn't require or motivate you to look at the trend of where those targets are going. But if you're looking at the longer term, then you want to be looking at those trends.
I think America's a great insight, and they're getting to the point now over there. And I went to a conference after Thrive. I went to America, and it was a real estate conference talking about, it was more focused on the technology of a building in terms of measuring and monitoring building systems and all that sort of stuff. But really what was coming out of it was they've got some they're you know, probably maybe 4 years, 5 years ahead of us in terms of regulatory compliance and carbon emission reporting.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're getting to over there, and, you know, this is a conference where people were getting up to speak that, we're representing companies that have $150 billion worth of real estate assets, you know, so big people. But what they were saying was if they go to buy a building now, they will not buy a building if there isn't a carbon reduction strategy plan attached to that building. So if your carbon reduction strategy plan, and this is all heading towards, they're, you know, crazy about getting to net zero by 2050 or even earlier, they're pretty bullish and ambitious. But basically they're saying, well, your carbon reduction strategy plan might say that it will cost more than what the building's worth to reduce it to be 2050. So they're not even going to buy your building now, because they're like, well, we don't want to add to our problem. We've already got $150 billion worth of problems. We actually only want to buy assets that we can resolve and make carbon neutral, that's cost effective, or that is already carbon neutral, or we're not even going to touch a building. So I think that, you know, you say, is this a good business model? Things are moving relatively quickly, and I think a lens into what's happening in America is a great insight. They're litigious, and, you know, it's all about risk management and return on investment. They are in it for the environment, but they're very much in it for the shareholders as well. So if there's not a proper return on investment, they're not interested either. Yeah. So they're making buildings, old buildings, 100-year-old buildings, carbon neutral, and they're finding return on investments on that. Yeah. So I think that if you want a high quality asset that's going to be worth something, and it, you know, we might be talking in 10 years' time that the realization comes that if it's going to cost too much to retrofit, then your building could actually be worthless.
Yeah. So it's just as much about reducing your liability and your future risk as well.
As well. I mean, the amount of boxes that you can tick by going down that passive house pathway, it's like, it's not two birds, one stone, about 10.
Right.
You
know,
it's a really great value. When you look at it like that, the value for money on achieving it is insane, because you're talking about, you know, future-proofing yourself against all the stuff that's coming, let alone better experience for the tenant, let alone lower power bills, you know, all that sort of stuff. So,
just to wrap up, Ben, talking about tenants, so the building is tenanted now. How's it going?
Yep. Yeah, good. And we're having a little bit of a chat about this beforehand. So, I guess our experience, and it's probably a little bit the same. There was someone else at the conference. Was it Kieran with the Geelong Library Childcare Centre?
I'm still trying to get her on the show, because that was fantastic.
But also the guy down. I'm sure it's down in Melbourne somewhere. But anyway, a little bit the same thing. The point is user behaviour and people's expectations around thermal comfort in office spaces, or maybe let's say commercial buildings versus residential, you know, that's something that requires a bit of tweaking and probably some tropical, subtropical, you know, idiosyncrasies that have sort of happened. And for the most part, people like the building. People enjoy being in the space, and obviously all the architecture and all that sort of stuff plays a role. They like the air quality. There's a noticeable difference. We are a little bit light on the cooling side, so happy to admit that we will be adding some additional cooling. But and something I was explaining to you is the logic of the user that happens in PHPP doesn't necessarily translate to the logic of the real world user that walks in the door.
Yeah. Well, especially in the Gold Coast, and you know, PHPP allows for 10% overheating, which is actually a reasonable chunk of time.
Yeah, it is, and that's probably the 10%. When you've got a commercial space, if it's a residential house, you put up with it, you go in the pool, you go to the beach, whatever.
Or you're at work when that's, you know,
or you're
in the
at work,
of the
right?
Day.
Yeah.
That's and, a really good point. So people are there during the hottest part of the day.
Yeah. And so that 10% time is the time when a tenant's going to complain.
Yeah. So in their terms, it's probably more than 10% because they're experiencing.
Ironically, we've got temperature sensors on each floor with a little tablet, and users can go up and they can see what the temperature and humidity is in the space. And so within the first week, I walked through the spaces and I could see that they'd open that page up, and then the complaints were coming because the number on the screen was, the number on screen was saying that it was 26 degrees and they want it to be 24. And
yeah,
so,
well,
you know, this whole definition of what is thermal comfort, if they hadn't have seen that number, there might have been less complaints. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but I bet it was a lot more than 26 degrees across the road.
Oh, 100%. And I mean, yeah, exactly. Or, you know, they would have you know, the amount of air conditioning or the
they were pumping it down with massive amounts of air con. Yeah, yeah.
Huge amounts. Yeah, probably leaving it on overnight and all sorts of crazy stuff. But yeah, so anyway, it's been really good to have someone come in and stress test the building and really take those that theoretical, and I don't want to say that PHP's, it's got its tweaks and, I think it's something that's always continually improving, but taking the stress tests of a commercial tenant and their feedback and being able to, really we're going to modify a couple little bits and pieces and it's going to be minimal interruption to the tenant and minimal cost, and then we'll be able to take those problems away. Again, I still think that's even a win,
Absolutely.
It's been really positive, and it's just been good to have people in there enjoying and appreciating the space, even when it's 38 degrees and 91% humidity outside.
Awesome. Hey, well done. People can check out, you've got a page for the project?
Yeah, for the building. Yeah, so then cornerblockgc.com.au. They can go there and have a look at all the specs and stuff.
Are you going to do another one?
I don't think I'd do another building, but certainly taking all the learnings, and that's what we're doing now, is taking all the learnings, and my ability to repeat and build another one is limited, but my ability to share the knowledge that we built is scalable. So really what we're doing now is building a platform to be able to scale that knowledge and sort of democratize it so that it's available to anyone, and so we can sort of start this chain reaction of people going out and building their own ones, but off the back of my learnings and knowledge, so they don't have to repeat, the same mistakes.
Love it. Awesome. Thank you, Ben. Cool. Really appreciate your time.
No, thanks, Matthew.
It's been great. Enjoy that the rest of the Queensland summer.
Yeah, we'll do. It's down to the beach, I think.
Nice. All right.
Awesome. Thanks, Matt.
Cheers, Ben. And that was Ben Sinclair, who is the founder and the manager of Cornerblock, which is a now tenanted commercial property in Queensland on the Gold Coast in Australia. What do you think, Zach?
It was excellent. It was like one, this kind of witnessing this collision that's going on between the split incentive problem, where he referred to owners passing on the problem to landlords who are passing on the problem to tenants, and that problem is poor performing buildings and energy inefficiency and heat. So that colliding with this fortunately some policy, as you mentioned, with neighbors and also the recognition, growing recognition, that if we don't make buildings, if we don't deal with the carbon emissions and resilience of buildings now, at some point they're going to, those buildings will lose their value, and so it's just, I think he's operating in this interesting place where it's a little bit early days for the market to really recognize that, but that with things like neighbors requiring becoming more, applicable to more and more buildings, because I think he was referring to it being, applying to buildings of 2,000 square meters or larger, and then 1,000 square meters and larger, and then 500 square meters and larger.
Yeah.
That, the writing's on the wall. And it was a really kind of fascinating conversation about that.
I wonder if some of that comes from his background. It's a family business, and so he's probably thinking about legacy, and it's so easy for other developers to just build something quick as they can, cheap as they can, sell it and move on to the next one. But if you're thinking about, hang on, I'm in this position as a developer because of my circumstances, and what are the circumstances we're going to be passing on to to future generations. If you've got that much more long-term view of things, it definitely changes how you might put something together and realize that a building's going to be around for potentially longer than you are. And could be having some problems, not just from a carbon point of view, but climate-wise, that was something that also stood out for me. I mean, I know it can get pretty warm up in that part of the world, and I've worked in a place, even here in Auckland, which gets pretty uncomfortable, both in the middle of winter and also more and increasingly in the middle of summer, because some of these commercial buildings are they're pretty basic. They're literally tilt slab concrete walls with a metal roof and barely any insulation on the roof. Now, that's fine if you're using it as essentially a storage facility, except it's not even fine then because it's not like that storage facility is never going to have humans inside it. And often they're not the best paid humans, you know, and as Ben talked about, it's already become a real worker health and safety issue. If you've got people in 40 degree heat, 40 degrees Celsius, that is, you know, over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, doing physical labor, your productivity is going to suffer for a start, but at some point you're going to have more serious issues.
Well, yeah, right, and you refer to, you know, workers literally fainting.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I think that's why we're seeing a policy response and you know, which is so important because if you're a buy and hold or if you build a building with the intention of holding it for a very, very long time, like Ben and also like Shane Pollan, the developer on the US, that completely changes your perspective. But if you're not, then you can easily discount the future and kind of ignore it and pass it on to other people, which is that's the split incentive. There's no incentive for people to make the investments in making better buildings, but that. As we all become more aware of it, aware of the fact that the writing's on the wall, at some point the market's going to, you know, is going to recognize, oh, wait, it doesn't, like, is this, this building is not gonna, I shouldn't buy this building.
Yeah.
From this developer because this building is not going to meet the requirements that, the basic requirements for, you know, human safety in the future. What an interesting time.
That's something similar happening here where I think people are becoming, I'm hoping because I'm talking about it as much as I can, is pointing out that some of our building codes are actually not fit for purpose. Like there's this assumption that if you buy a new house or a new building today, you're essentially going to be looked after. We have this kind of assumption, I think, in a consumer world where, well, if I can buy it, surely all the necessary safety checks have been done. And that's just not the case for a lot of our buildings because they have moisture issues. We're starting to experience overheating issues in our building. And here in New Zealand and kind of in Australia as well, overheating is actually not even in the building code. So there's no requirement to even consider it. So we need to educate the public that that's one of the benefits of things like Passive House and other standards, that you're actually going to get something which is not over and above, you know, this or something outrageously, I hesitate to use the word high performance sometimes because I think that sets it aside as something it's elite almost. It's actually just fit for purpose. And some building codes are not that. They're not actually fit for purpose.
Right. What was it? Talina Edwards was at the conference was saying appropriate.
That's right.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, me too. You know, another thing that I was struck by is also the importance of a good code or other rating systems too. Like the fact that he was already on the path to Green Star certification.
Mm-hmm.
That was already in his mind as they were designing the building, or as his team was. And even though they were a couple years into it when he discovered that he really wanted and needed to do Passive House, the fact that they were already on that pathway meant that the extra kind of effort to get to Passive House wasn't that much.
Yeah.
And that it was really a focus on detailing and I think on airtightness. And I think we see a similar thing in places where there's a strong energy code that's not quite at Passive House, but like in the state of Washington, to make the step from base energy code here to Passive House is not a major leap, because we're already looking at HRVs in many buildings. Mm. And you know, there are already requirements for good windows and insulation and all that stuff. So I think that's that again, and this is something that's come up in previous episodes when we've been talking about the state of things down under with building code, the role of other certification programs is also just really important to kind of to up the game.
Yeah.
And then the delta to actually bring it all the way to Passive House is just not that. It's not a big thing.
Yeah. And then the other thing I quite like about Ben's presentations and the way he talks about the whole project, he's quite open about the whole process, and you know, we're familiar with that in the Passive House scene, is that people are generally open to sharing what's gone well, but also what they'd do differently next time. And you know, Ben was already he realised a few tweaks that need to be made once tenants moved in, and is working through that. And I think that's incredibly valuable, and you know, to share amongst the community and not just pretend that it's not happening, but be open about it and say, you know, this is how we would do things differently next time, or this is the changes that we need to be made once people actually started using the building. So really appreciate that from Ben.
Yeah, I think kind of in line with that too, I felt like he was really like honest and kind of clear-eyed about it when you asked him does the business model work? And
yeah.
There was a good healthy pause there. Yeah. And considered his response. And yeah. I think in the end there was, you know, I think that he feels like if you're a developer who's going to, or an owner who's going to hold on to a building for a long time, absolutely it works now.
Yeah.
Maybe not at this moment, but that's going to change.
Yep.
Because of, you know, and then he was sharing the anecdote of the conference in the U.S. where you have these massive builder or developers or real estate holding companies who are, you know, looking at, what is it? What was the term? The strategy that was of interesting carbon reduction strategy plan. What's your carbon reduction strategy plan? Is that plan more expensive than the building? You know, like it's,
yeah,
if you were actually, you know, like there's a whole analysis going on that could I guess it comes back in some ways to the whole concept of stranded assets potentially.
Yeah.
So let's make sure we don't compound the problem by building
keep
a bunch of crappy
stranded
buildings.
Stranded assets. Yeah,
yeah.
Very good. Well, highly recommend a trip to the Gold Coast when everyone gets the chance. Go and say hello to Ben, check out the building. I'm sure he'd be pleased to show you around.
Awesome.
Thank you for that. What do we got coming up?
Well, this week on Wednesday, March 20th, we have a project showcase edition of Passive House Accelerator Live. We'll be joined by Mike Delafave of Rhodey Architects, and he'll be presenting single-family Passive House, Proving the Model. It's a really cool three-house development in Massachusetts. Really beautiful. It was featured in Wall Street Journal. So we're excited to have him on the program. And also just make sure to check out the Reimagine Buildings issue of Passive House Accelerator magazine. It's beautiful. Lots of great stories in there. We're really proud to be able to share that with everybody.
Definitely. Awesome. All right. Thanks for that, Zach. We'll be back again next week with a regular episode of Passive House Podcast.